Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
It has been over two decades since the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. I remember clearly the evening that the Berlin Wall fell, an event that marked a significant change in the way that I viewed the world. Likewise, the slow unraveling of the Soviet Union in the subsequent 2 years was a sight to behold, with the world holding its breath for several days wondering if a military coup would wrest power from Mikhail Gorbachev, or whether Boris Yeltsin's parliamentary rebellion would succeed. The closing decade of the 20th century seemed to hold great promise for a region that had known nothing but autocracy for most of the 1900s. Nonetheless, the road to full-fledged democracy has been a bumpy one. While the Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania have done well in democratic terms, the political ride for other nations in the former Soviet Union has been a bit more bumpy, with Vladimir Putin appearing to emerge as a new version of a dictatorial czar under the patina of an electoral regime, and other countries following suit. For those of us scholars watching the religious landscape, however, the remarkable political transformations occurring over the past two decades has offered up the opportunity to observe a natural experiment take shape. How did the regimes that emerged in the post-communist era regulate confessional organizations? Would religious liberty for all be the norm? Or would certain historical denominations be favored over new upstart and missionary groups? And how are church-state relations being managed in the less-than-democratic regimes that have emerged in places like Russia, Belarus, and Uzbekistan? To answer these questions, I am pleased to have with me today Professor Ani Sarkissian, an assistant professor of political science at Michigan State University, where she is also a faculty member in the Muslim Studies program, as well as the Center for European, Russian, and Eurasian Studies. She earned her Ph.D. in political science at UCLA, go Bruins, a program known for producing some of the finest minds on issues pertaining to church and state, I must say with complete objectivity. She is also completing a book manuscript on religion under authoritarian regimes and is a co-investigator on a project looking at charismatic Catholicism in sub-Saharan Africa, a rich curriculum vitae indeed. Ani, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me.
One of the other things that I failed to note in the introduction is that you're our second guest joining us from outside the United States. And I think you're now in Montreal, Canada, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's the last time I checked. Michigan State University is not in Canada unless the Canadians invaded the U.S. and reclaimed Michigan. So what's going on up there? Why are you in Canada?
Well, Tony, hardy California native that I am, I decided winters in Michigan were just not cold enough, and I needed a bigger challenge this year.
There you go. Yeah.
I'm in Montreal. No, but seriously, I had a chance to take a leave from Michigan State this year to work on my book manuscript and had the opportunity to spend it in Montreal. So I'm currently a visitor at the Department of Political Science at McGill University, where I've met a bunch of really great folks. But I'm going to be returning to the U.S. and the Spartans in the fall.
Okay, well, those cold winters will help you focus more on your book than doing other things, hanging out outside or something. And it's good to have a guest from Canada because we do have a regular listener from Moose Jaw, Canada, which I'm very proud of. So a big call out to all you Canadians who are listening in. The other international guest we've had on the show was Jonathan Fox, who is a co-author with you on another article. Is that correct?
Yes, that's true.
Okay, well, we will link to his earlier podcast as well as some of the other ones we've done with other folks related to this topic, such as Carrie Casel and Catherine Wanner. So please check out our website to find out more about that kind of stuff. Okay, so you've written quite extensively on the role of religion under authoritarian regimes, and you're preparing a book manuscript on that topic now that actually looks at church-state relations under autocracy all around the globe, examining some 100 countries that span over the past 50 years or so. Today, however, I want to focus on the former Soviet Union and Eastern Bloc, your area of main specialty. And as I mentioned in the introduction, there's a great deal of hope in this region of the world, hoping that democracy would emerge following the end of communism. You know, Francis Fukuyama even wrote a book declaring the end of history, meaning that democratic capitalism is one of the big debates in the 20th century. So the 1990s were filled with a great deal of hope. But for our listeners, including me, who are not all that familiar with the politics of the post-Soviet states, what has been going on out there for the last maybe 10 or 12 years?
Well, as you mentioned in your introduction, when the Berlin Wall fell, which is actually a day I remember vividly myself and one of the reasons I chose to study what I did in graduate school.
Actually, let me stop you there. Where were you? Do you remember it vividly? Because that was a huge moment in my time when the Berlin Wall fell.
I was in high school in my living room watching TV.
Yeah, I was in graduate school at UCLA, and I had an apartment. It was a split-level apartment with a couple guys, and they were downstairs watching something on HBO or something, and I saw this stuff on CNN, and I'm like, whoa, Berlin Wall fell. And you know, I was a political scientist taking classes in the communist world and all this stuff, and we were thinking that China would be the first one to fall and not the Soviet Union or Eastern Europe. And I remember walking down the stairs and telling these guys, listen, you guys got to turn on CNN. You're not going to believe this, but the Berlin Wall is falling. And I paused and I said, yeah, not literally, just figuratively. And it was literally falling. I mean, people taking hammers to it, climbing over it, and everything. So it was a monumental event in history. And I do try to convey that to my students. And again, it issued in throughout the 1990s, this just amazing hope that the world is changing for a better democratic future. We finally come to the end of history, as Fukuyama said. But go ahead, continue, and tell us what's happened since then.
Right. So there was this hope that we would have this kind of global democratic revolution. People like the late Samuel Huntington sawing these developments to be part of this third wave of democratizations that started in the 1970s and was now going to continue into Eastern Europe. But what actually happened after the fall of the Berlin Wall didn't live up to the optimistic forecasts. We did have a sizable group of successful democratic transitions and consolidation, and these were mostly in Eastern Europe and the Baltics, so the more kind of the countries that were more in the western part of the communist bloc. And we've even seen many of these countries, actually most of them, are now even part of the European Union. So countries like Bulgaria and the Czech Republic and Latvia and Lithuania. And so there's various factors that scholars have used to explain these successes in democratization, including the fact that many of these countries had a shorter history of communism than some of the more Eastern Soviet republics. Some people say that they had better developed civil societies, so they were able to kind of transition into democracy more easily. There's also this issue of neighborhood effects, so the fact that they were closer to other established democracies made it, gave them kind of a good influence to follow and made it easier for them to become democratic. On the other end of the spectrum, however, we had some pretty spectacular failures to democratize. The Central Asian stans, such as Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan, come to mind. But we also have other countries like Belarus that fall into these kind of failures to democratize. And here again, we can use some of the same explanations that I just mentioned, but we can also add some other ones, at least in the case of Central Asia. So such things such as poorly developed national identities that came from Soviet divide and rule policies that really split up ethnic groups into different geographic regions. There's the influence of clan politics in some of these places, dependence on natural resources for economic development. So again, several factors that might explain why these countries didn't succeed in the democratization process.
You know, one of the countries we oftentimes forget about in that region is Belarus. I mean, we've heard of Russia. It's a very big nation geographically, so it's hard to forget that one. And we've heard of Kazakhstan because of Borat and other things like that. But Belarus, that's the one of all the countries, that's probably the most dictatorial one remaining, right?
Yes. Yeah, it is. And, I mean, in many ways, it's, I don't know, it's somewhat followed Russia's lead in that case and has had quite a close relationship with Russia throughout the throughout this process. So that could be one explanation for why Belarus has turned out the way that it has.
And where is Belarus, by the way, for us not familiar with it on the map?
Belarus is kind of south of Russia, and let's see, you're testing my geography.
I am testing your geography because you're with that center on, you know, European studies and Russia and stuff like that. So,
east of Ukraine.
Okay.
So, and I hope I got that right. Otherwise, I'll be embarrassed.
No, that's okay. We're not geographers. We're political scientists. So that's
right,
okay.
Right. So we've got these two kind of extremes on this spectrum of what happened after the Berlin Wall collapsed, and then we have a group of countries that are caught somewhere in the middle between democracy and authoritarianism. And oftentimes we talk about these as experiencing stalled democratization. So these are countries like Georgia, Armenia, Albania, Ukraine. And for the last few years, scholars have been trying to kind of figure out what to call these regimes. So they've come up with names like hybrid regimes, or semi-democracies, or liberalized autocracies. There's a million names for what to call these countries kind of in the middle.
Yeah, political scientists are very good at coming up with names for different regimes.
Yes, yeah. We are. But one I think that is a pretty good descriptive name is competitive authoritarianism.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, there's actually a great book by Stephen Levitsky and Lucan Wei by the same name that goes into this phenomenon in greater detail, but very briefly, what competitive authoritarian regimes are those that have on paper things like elections and protection of civil liberties. So they look like democracy on paper, but these things are systematically violated to favor the incumbent. So you might have a legal opposition that's allowed to compete in elections, but there's enough violations of rights and procedures that they're not on a level playing field with the incumbent, and they're not likely to win, though there is a chance for them to win. So there's competition, but it's unfair. So we can contrast this with hegemonic or closed authoritarian regimes where there's no competition or uncertainty, even if there are elections that are held periodically. So there's various explanations for why some states are stuck in this pattern of governance.
It seems to be a slow slide that it occurs, because again, during the 1990s, there was, you know, Boris Yeltsin was, you know, kind of democratic, and you know, you had the Ukrainian Orange Revolution and things are looking good there, so you're feeling pretty good. But then, you know, a year later, and then, you know, the president or the prime minister does something to, you know, take away press freedoms or to bolster his party relative to somebody else. I mean, is that how this stuff is? It's kind of like a creeping authoritarianism?
It is, it is. And I think Russia's a good example there. Just before I get to that example, it's a creeping authoritarianism, but it's actually become kind of a stable condition for many countries. So it's so stable that scholars of comparative politics are now considering this to be a unique regime type that is something different from democracy and different from authoritarianism. It's kind of its own thing. But let's just talk about Russia real quickly to illustrate kind of how this slow creep happens.
Okay.
So as you mentioned, Russia under Yeltsin in the 90s looked like it might be headed in a democratic direction, but it never got there. You know, there was a good degree of competition and pluralism under Yeltsin, and, you know, there people were kind of optimistic about it. But by the time Vladimir Putin took over the presidency in 2000, he started instituting different policies and doing things that kind of slowly entrenched authoritarianism in the country. So he did things like, he built this strong governing party, United Russia, that ended up controlling the legislature, and it ended up really just being subservient to the executive. He consolidated the provinces into a smaller number of regions, and he got rid of elections for regional governors. He nationalized sectors of the economy, like the oil and gas industry, so he was able to control a lot of the economy. He attacked independent media. So here we see these various steps that Putin is taking to consolidate power more and more in the executive, and now we find Russia to be a pretty stable hegemonic or closed authoritarian regime.
Oh, so it has crossed that boundary from being a competitive authoritarianism to a hegemonic authoritarianism?
That many scholars would argue that it has.
How would you know that? I mean, one of the things you do in the paper that you recently wrote on this, and this is what we're basing our interview around today, you provide some measures. And I've always wondered, well, how do we know how authoritarian a regime is? Do they hang a sign at the entrance to their country saying, welcome to hegemonic authoritarianville, please check your civil liberties at the door? Or how are we determining that Russia is now hegemonic authoritarian, whereas Ukraine and Albania are more competitive authoritarian?
Well, it would help us if they actually did hang those signs.
Yeah, that would be good.
Because it is hard to tell. There are several groups of scholars and independent institutions that, like Freedom House is an example of one, that take as their task rating political regimes and trying to decide. Some of them will say, you know, decide whether a country is democratic or authoritarianism, either one or the other. Others will have more of a scale, which is what Freedom House has. So what I do is I actually look at a number of different of these rankings to try to determine what kinds of regimes different countries have. And they tend to agree on the cases that are at the extremes. So the you know, really clear democracies people agree on, and the really clear autocracies people agree on. But it's those countries kind of in the middle, right? These more competitive authoritarian regimes where you find some disagreement among scholars.
Yeah, because I would have probably said that Russia still has some competitive nature to its authoritarianism, because there have been protests in the past year, and yeah, some punk rock bands get thrown into prison and things like that, but there's a lot more dissent than there had been during the Soviet era. So I guess it's kind of a judgment call of where we draw that line.
Right.
Okay. Well, speaking of what happens in these regimes, a large number of political scientists have become interested in studying this reversion to authoritarian rule and its varying degrees that we talked about here, but they tend to focus on trying to understand how autocrats like Putin in Russia or Viktor Yushchenko Viktor Yanukovych of the Ukraine, how they manipulate political parties and elections in their favor. And that's something that as political scientists oftentimes gravitate to, elections and political parties and things like that. You argue, however, that we need to cast a wider net to understand the politics of these regimes by understanding how they relate to entities within civil society, such as religion.
Right. So, as you said, political scientists like us tend to focus a lot on institutions, so things like elections and political parties and judiciaries, which is natural since these are the building blocks of political systems and it's what makes them function. So, for example, when the Berlin Wall fell and the new republics began to emerge and they began to democratize, political scientists were paying a lot of attention to the types of institutions that were being created in these countries. So, for example, there were these great debates about whether establishing a presidential or parliamentary system was going to be better for long-term democratic prospects.
Mm-hmm.
But as we just discussed, there was a lot of divergence in the trajectories the countries took. And a lot of us were left wondering why countries that had perfectly good-looking democratic institutions set up in their constitutions on paper didn't look very democratic in real life.
Yeah.
And I argue that this is due to the lack of attention being paid to civil liberties protections in these countries. So, for example, we pay a lot of attention to how elections are conducted on the day that ballots are cast, right? We send out election observers, and we really want to make sure, you know, votes are being counted well and there are transparent voting boxes and things like that. But we don't pay as much attention to how things like how much press freedom exists in a country, or whether civil society groups, which are groups of people who are independent from the government, whether they're able to meet and voice their opinions in the public sphere. And, you know, I consider religious organizations to fall into this sphere of civil society. These are all things that kind of go into determining whether those elections that people are going to go vote in on a particular day are competitive, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot that goes into competition before the actual election itself. And so I think that focusing on civil liberties really points to this issue of the quality of democracy, which I feel goes to the heart of this distinction between consolidated democracies like Poland and the Czech Republic, competitive authoritarian regimes like Georgia or Albania, and hegemonic authoritarian regimes like Russia and Uzbekistan.
Yeah, and I like your focus on this because, again, as we talk about how this authoritarianism didn't come about in one day with a military coup or anything, it's a creeping authoritarianism that occurs over time, that you're looking at what is happening to civil society and the different groups therein is like looking at a canary in a coal mine. You start to see the canary choking a little bit, and you're saying, uh-oh, there might be some trouble here, and we oftentimes miss those signs.
Right.
Now, there's something that you note in these authoritarian and quasi-authoritarian regimes of great importance. And I one of the reasons I like your research is because you don't see these things as monolithic or all the same. There's a great deal of variation in there. While the Soviet Union back in the 1940s or 30s or 20s was generally hostile to all religious organizations, there's been a great deal of variety in how these new nations, from Russia to Uzbekistan to Albania, manage their religious organizations today. So what does that variation look like? Normally, we would think that authoritarian regime just crushes everybody in civil society, but no, there's some variation. So what's happening there?
Right. So in my book and in this paper that focuses on the former communist countries, I focus on religious repression, which I'm measuring by looking at government policies that are severely and significantly restricting religious freedom. So I'm looking at things like policies that are repressing religious expression rights, so things like the right to attend religious services or to construct houses of worship, and the right to express religion politically. So those would be things like the right to organize into political groups based on religion, or the right for a religious clergy to run for political office. And there are a lot of ways to categorize variation in religion policy across states, and there are different scholars who come up with these with different categories. And I wanted to try to do something that was simple, but that captured kind of what was going on. So I focus at how many religious groups a state represses. So I have four categories, and again, I'm looking at non-democratic states in this region. So my four categories are, first, states that repress all religions, which in the former communist bloc includes Azerbaijan and all of the Central Asian countries except Kyrgyzstan. Second is states that repress all but one religion, which includes Armenia, Belarus, Georgia, Moldova, and Russia.
And so in those, there's all but one. So there's a favored religion, and everybody else, it sucks to be them.
Exactly.
Okay.
The third category is states that repress some religions. So here, it might be that there is, there are a few religions that are favored, and then there are others that are repressed. But there isn't, like the previous category, there isn't one religious group that's obviously favored to the detriment of the rest. So this includes Bosnia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine.
Okay.
And then finally, I have a category of states that repress no religions. And in this group of countries, there's only one, which is Albania.
Albania. I would have not predicted Albania.
No.
Which is...
Albania is not a country that comes to mind, to most people's minds.
Yeah, that had one of the more stranger communist regimes back in the 70s and 80s, I think. But good for Albania. We'll get there. We'll figure out what's going on with Albania. So we got this variation. We got four categories. They're all religions repressed, all but one, some, and then none. What is your general explanation for why this variation is occurring?
So I argue that religion policy in authoritarian and semi-authoritarian regimes, so these kind of hybrid regimes, is a product of competition, and specifically the competition between religious and political interests. And specifically, I've got three religious factors and three political factors that I focus on. So I'll go through them very quickly,
okay.
And we can talk about them in more detail when we talk about some countries. But on the religious side, I look at the number and size of religious groups. And this might sound familiar to you, Tony, since it's something that you've done or worked on in the past. But the argument that I'm following here is one that comes from scholars like you who focus on economic-based arguments to explain religious outcomes. So here the expectation is that larger groups that are more likely to be threatening to politicians than smaller groups are going to be the ones that are targeted because they have the potential to organize into viable opposition movements that can depose politicians.
Mm-hmm.
But also important here is the number of religious groups in society because that affects the amount of competition that there is among groups and between the groups in the state. So there's a marketplace issue going on there. A second religious factor that I look at, and one I think that scholars often ignore, is the identity of religious groups. So what are these groups about? Who are they identified with? And here, what I argue is that they're groups that are, say, threatening to the legitimacy of the regime or other religions in society, often larger societies, are going to be more threatening than those that don't challenge existing authority. So they're going to be the targets of repression more often than groups that don't challenge the regime.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes these are small groups. They're not really large groups. Similarly, groups that espouse extremist ideologies or promote violence obviously are going to draw the attention of politicians more than those that are peaceful. So here I'm really trying to focus on not just the size of groups, but also, you know, whether these groups have a specific ideology or something that's going to make them targets, even if they are small groups in terms of population.
Mm-hmm.
A third religious factor is historical religion-state relations. So, for example, it might be that there are religions who have a history of close relations with the state, so they are likely to be subjected to less repression than those that have had traditionally antagonistic relations with it. Or there might be state institutions that existed during colonial periods or other periods that might be carried over into current politics. So we really need to look at these things as well to understand how state religion policy operates today. And then politically, I'm looking at the real and perceived domestic and international strength and stability of the authoritarian regime to see how likely leaders are going to be to focus on religion as a policy realm that they can manipulate to serve their interests, right? Because as much as we would like to believe this because we study religion, religion is often not the kind of first area of interest
for
politicians in their policymaking.
Yeah, they basically are trying to secure their own political survival until the next day, next week, or next month and bring in a lot of revenue in that church stuff. Yeah, we'll get to that later once we do that other stuff first.
Right, but I argue that there actually are political reasons why they might decide to focus on religion as a policy mechanism, right, as a tool that they can use to perhaps suppress opposition or make sure that they hold on to their rule. So these have to do with things like the type of authoritarian regime that exists and the level of the state's coercive apparatus, so kind of how secure it is in its authoritarianism and how strong that authoritarianism is. Also, the linkage of the state to the international community and its relations with foreign powers, so if it's getting pressure from outside states to address religious freedom issues, might determine how it deals with religion policy, and also whether it subscribes to a particular ideology that affects its relations with religious groups. So together, these six factors determine the number of groups that are targeted by state religion policy, as well as which specific groups are targeted for repression. And I think it's really important that we identify the targets of repression. So, you know, as you've pointed out in your own work, politicians in crafting and implementing their religion policy are mostly motivated by their desire to restrict political competition, secure their own power, right? Make sure things go okay so they can keep ruling and not have problems to deal with in the religious realm. But what I try to do is to extend that argument to look more specifically at factors related to how authoritarian states are governed, because these operate under different competitive environments than democratic states do.
And I really like the extensions that you're doing, and I also like the fact that you mentioned my work, and you get extra bonus points for that. But if you want extra special bonus points, if you mention the title of my last book on this podcast, then I can link it up on the website, and people can go visit it.
So the title of your last book, you mean the Origins of...
the political origins.
Political origins of religious liberty.
Yes, I'll score. Okay, folks, that will now be linked on our website. I can't just come out and say it, but you know, if we gets our guest to say it, then it gets mentioned. So, so folks, go visit and pick up that one. But no, you do extend a lot of the things that I had been talking about, and correct me in several different areas, which I think is very good. One of the things that you mentioned here, and I want to ask you a little bit about this. You talk about the historical religion-state relations in society. And this picks up some of my former students, Ahmed Carew, and some of my friends, Chris Soper and Joel Fetzer, have talked about these historical church-state relations. I'm somewhat curious about that because, you know, when I think of the Soviet Union lasts for, you know, roughly 80 some odd years, and it really goes out and tries to obliterate church-state relations. The Russian Orthodox Church still hangs around a little bit, but does that historical relationship still matter for Russia after, you know, such a blitz against the Russian Orthodox Church for 80 years? I mean, that's several generations.
It does, and not just for Russia, but for all of the other countries as well. I mean, the first thing to note is that the church-state relations during the Soviet period were not consistent, right? So there were various periods of kind of greater repression followed by loosenings of repression. So there was relations were kind of in flux,
right.
And that's partly why these churches were able to survive for all of these years, despite a pretty intensive campaign by the state to enforce atheism. But, you know, there are still issues that many of these countries are dealing with in terms of kind of the level of trust that there is in some of these institutions. So, for example, it's well known that many of the higher clergy in the Russian Orthodox Church, for example, were associated with the KGB, probably not by choice, but there is still some distrust of some of these groups. But at the same time, that there's this feeling of a close connection between the traditional religions, the traditional churches of these countries, and what it means to be Russian or Belarusian or Ukrainian,
yeah,
or Tajik or whatever. These are legacies that persist today. And some of the institutions that existed during the Soviet period, we find very similar versions of them in the post-Soviet period.
Yeah, that's one of the fascinating things about your work that you do bring up, that the resilience of some of these groups and how then they're used again by politicians to reconstruct a new nationalism or something of that. The other one that I wanted to bring up in your thesis, you had 6 points here, and I think it was number 5, and that deals with the political issues, is relations with foreign powers or pressure from foreign powers in order to get their civil liberties in order. And we've talked with a number of folks such as Dan Philpott and Thomas Farr and Timothy Shaw about the issue of international religious freedom. And I've always been a little bit suspicious or maybe skeptical of how much influence another country can have on an authoritarian or quasi-authoritarian regime when it comes to getting them to get their civil liberties in order. Are you finding that some international pressure really does affect how these countries manage their relations with different religious groups?
Well, I think that pressure probably has more of an effect on countries that are kind of closer to the democratic end of the spectrum than the authoritarian one. So
yeah,
the leader of Turkmenistan is probably not going to take that kind of pressure very seriously. However, you do have countries, for instance, the Eastern European countries that wanted to join the EU, you know, they're going to reform their religion laws if the EU decides that they don't live up to European or international standards.
Mm-hmm.
Turkey is another example where,
right,
Turkey in recent years has actually made lots of gains in civil liberties protections, even though it still has a way to go, because of pressure to conform to the Copenhagen criteria. So I do think that there is a role that international pressure can play. I don't know that it's, the number one factor, but I do think that there is some pressure. Individual countries might not be as as successful in pressuring as, say, regional organizations like the EU.
Yeah, and I think where that carrot is being dangled has a great deal of impact in place, saying, oh, okay, yeah, I guess we'll lay off on some of the religious groups if we can have access to trade in your nations and such. Yeah. Okay, hey, so let's go ahead and we have the general thesis that you have here on these focus of, you know, different religious factors, different political factors. Let's go ahead and look at your four categories separately of the groups that you talk about, the ones that repress all, repress some, all but one, and then none. So let's go ahead and do that and see what's the logic guiding the decisions of some of these political leaders, and maybe give a example of one of the countries that are in here. Let's go ahead and start with the category all religions repressed. Now, one thing that I noted in your paper is that that group contains basically all of the Stan countries or Stan republics, such as Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and then Azerbaijan, which is not a Stan. The only one that's not there is Kyrgyzstan. One of the things I noted there was that all these regions are predominantly Muslim in culture. Is that a factor? And what else is going on there that they're repressing all religions?
Right, so it's true that these are all countries that are predominantly Muslim in culture, but I don't believe that it's Islamic teachings that are the reason that they're all repressing religion similarly. In fact, like the other countries that we're going to talk about, these countries were all subjected to the atheist policy of the communist authorities. So we see religious practice and sentiments really declining during the communist period. You know, we've got some traditional religious practices and customs remaining in the countries, and once they became independent, we had, you know, people in these countries who kind of identified as Muslim, but they weren't particularly well versed in Islam. We find that this has changed over the years as people have become more interested in religion, and there's been more of an effort to educate people, both from within the countries and also from foreign missionaries from places like Iran and Turkey and Saudi Arabia have been coming into, especially the Stans, to open up religious schools and things. But we don't find kind of large Islamist movements that are calling for, say, greater government repression of non-Muslims in these countries. There aren't really big movements calling for Islamic republics. The repression is really coming from the secular elites that are controlling these countries. And I argue that a lot of these elites are actually motivated by anti-religious sentiments, like their communist predecessors, and some of whom were actually communists and are still in power. And like these communist predecessors, they fear religion. So just to talk about some of the ways that religious groups are repressed in these countries, I'd like to talk a little bit about Uzbekistan, because I think it's an interesting country. In the sense that it has some of the highest levels of repression among these countries, but it's also one of the more religious countries in Central Asia.
So tell us about Uzbekistan. That's a cool name to pronounce, too, Uzbekistan.
It is. Yeah. So in Uzbekistan, there are, and in a lot of the other countries that we'll talk about, one of the kinds of regulation that we see is the requirement for religious groups to register with the government. And in Uzbekistan, this government agency is called the Committee on Religious Affairs, and in order for groups to operate legally in the country, they have to have at least 100 citizens to register, and if they don't register and try to practice their religion, they face strict penalties that include fines and jail time. So without registration, they basically can't exist. And the committee has actually denied registration to several groups, and not just kind of what some might consider more fringe groups like Jehovah's Witnesses or smaller groups, but Baptist congregations, Roman Catholic congregations, pretty big Protestant and Pentecostal churches, as well as several Muslim groups. So just to give a comparison, in a lot of democratic countries, like the United States even, groups have to register with the government if they want to take advantage of things like tax credits, right? But they don't but groups aren't required to register to be legal religious groups, right? I can open a church and preach to my followers, and I don't have to let the government know that I'm doing this if I don't want to get anything from the government.
Right.
The difference, When these registration laws are repressive is when they make it illegal to practice religion without registering with the government. Some other ways that Uzbekistan represses religion is by really strictly controlling religious publications, what comes in and out of the country, controlling religious education. So, for example, private religious education is illegal in the country. They'll conduct surveillance of religious services. They'll do police raids on services. And they don't allow proselytizing, so people aren't allowed to go and spread their religion. But the thing that distinguishes Uzbekistan and the other countries in this category is that the repression is not only aimed at minorities, but it's also aimed at the majority Muslim population.
Yeah, that's what's interesting.
Right, and so some of these are, Muslims that belong to different sects from the majority population, right? So it might be that the government is going to target Shia Muslims because the majority group is Sunni Muslims in Uzbekistan. But there are also Sunni groups that are targeted, and the kind of majority is targeted. So, for example, the government restricts the number of people who are allowed to go on the Hajj, which is the annual pilgrimage to Mecca. So there's ways that the government is controlling religious practice within the country. And to target Muslims, these governments often find ways of labeling them as extremist and justifying their repression of them for reasons of national security.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are extremist groups operating in the region, so we can't say that all the actions that are being taken against these groups constitute violations of religious freedom, right? And we can allow governments to kind of go after groups that are promoting violence or targeting innocent citizens and things like that. But what we do find is that there are lots of groups that are targeted that don't appear to be extremists at all. So for an example, there's a group of Muslims in Uzbekistan and also around Central Asia and in other parts of the former Soviet Union, including Russia, that are called the Nur or Nurjular group. And they're associated with a Turkish religious scholar named Fethullah Gulen, and they're teaching specifically denounce violent extremism. They're kind of more of a liberal, tolerant group. But the Uzbek government labels them extremist and bans this group, and it's imprisoned a large number of its followers. So it's going after groups that are not extremist not particularly threatening, obviously threatening to the state. So what I kind of try to explain this by looking at some of the kind of historical religion-state relations, right, that we talked about before that have carried over into the present day. So in each of these countries, in Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Azerbaijan, we have kind of two government entities that regulate religion. We've got a State Committee on Religious Affairs, or something with a similar name that governs religious relations in general. And then we've also got a separate authority called the Spiritual Association for Muslims, or something like that, often referred to as a muftiyat, that directly controls Islam. And it controls an official version of Islam. And it does things like it has authority to appoint clergy. Sometimes they'll write sermons or they'll have to approve sermons before they're given during Friday services. They'll control the construction of new mosques or the repair of old ones. And as I mentioned previously, they'll oversee the pilgrimage to Mecca. So they're really kind of in charge of propagating an official form of Islam that's closely managed by the state and allows for no independent activity. And these are modeled on Soviet era institutions that, sometimes even have the same name, and they operate very similarly to them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's go ahead and move on to the next category here. So you do see these, attempts in Uzbekistan to control all the religions. You can see that the secular government is very threatened by anything religious and willing to basically label anything extremist that might threaten their hold on power. Let's go ahead and move to the next category, which is repressing all but one religion. What is the general logic here, and how does the one religion get to be picked as the one religion that is okay with everybody, or at least okay with the politicians?
All right, so here we've got five countries where the majority Orthodox Church is favored by the regime. So it's the kind of traditional religion of the majority of the population. And it's usually smaller groups that are usually of other Christian denominations that are targeted with the repression. So you'll have things like religions other than the Orthodox Church being required to register as entities and enjoying fewer rights and privileges than the Orthodox Church. They'll have problems renting and constructing meeting places, and sometimes they'll even be subject to attacks, either by citizen groups that aren't stopped by the police or, in other cases, by local officials. And Russia is really paradigmatic here because, like the other countries, it's favoring the Russian Orthodox Church, despite the fact that there are laws that do guarantee some level of religious freedom for other religious groups. And, you know, that hasn't always been the case in Russia. It's actually, we've seen a tightening of religious repression in Russia since independence.
Yeah, tell us about that, because when Yeltsin stood on the tank and declared that the Soviet Union is over and now we have a Russian Federation, et cetera, et cetera, I mean, he had so much on his plate to do to create a country. And you know, somebody asked him, hey, what are you going to do about religious freedom? And he's like, why should I care about that? Whatever you want to do. And it basically created this laissez-faire environment during the early to mid-1990s. So what happens?
Exactly. And actually, that environment was created in 1990 under Gorbachev. So during the kind of glasnost and perestroika period, there was a law that was passed in the Soviet Union that granted a good deal of religious freedom to religious to these new religious groups, not just to the new, to all religious groups. And so not only did it give greater freedom to groups that already existed in the Soviet Union, but it also enabled a lot of new groups to come into the country. And as the Soviet Union collapsed and borders were opened and more people could come in, we see lots of foreign missionaries coming into the country, the rise of new religious denominations. So there was a big growth in religion kind of initially in the initial post-communist period. As this was happening, groups like the Russian Orthodox Church, which was used to being the dominant religious group in the country, started to feel threatened. And so they kind of started pressuring Yeltsin's government to adopt or revise the legislation. And there were a few attempts in the early 90s to do this. But this didn't really work until 1997, when a new law was passed. And there are various reasons for why 97 was when this law was able to be adopted, but partly there were these demands from the public to stop the growth of new religious movements that just kind of reached this very high level, and so there was a lot of pressure on the state to do this, but also the state felt like it was losing control over the religious sector and wasn't really able to control what was going on in the religious sector, so it felt like it needed to manage what was happening. So in 97, the Duma passed a law on freedom of conscience and religious associations. And it's quite complicated, but very briefly, what it does is it creates kind of a tiered system of registration and of recognition of religious groups. So it identifies four groups as traditional religions: Christianity, Islam, Judaism, and Buddhism. And it says that these are inseparable from the country's history because they've been around for a long time in the various regions of Russia, which is a huge landmass. But it also recognizes the special contribution of the Russian Orthodox Church to the country. And what this does is it gives the Russian Orthodox Church kind of de facto privileged status with relation to the government. So even though we've got four kind of large groups that are recognized as traditional, the Russian Orthodox Church is really singled out as special. And then the law also created three categories of recognition of religious groups, And each has different status and different privileges. So there's kind of discrimination within the law among religious groups. And then since 1997, there have been other laws passed, most under the Putin regime, that, you know, not all of them are specifically name religion or are targeted religion, but they have had the effect of helping the regime repress religion. So, for example, in 2002, a law on countering extremist activity is used to target groups that are accused of inciting religious discord. There's a 2006 law on public associations that gives the government authority to monitor documents and events that are held by civil society groups, NGOs that includes religious organizations. And then there's a 2009 national security concept of the Russian Federation that's allowing the group to pursue groups that it suspects of extremist activity and ban them. So the government's actually used these laws to ban several groups, some of which are clearly violent, but others like this Nurjalar group that I mentioned before that are not.
Yeah, and I noticed that with the previous category that we're talking about, too, is that issue of extremism. And again, states have a vested interest in keeping a peaceful society, and they don't want to be overthrown, so one can understand that. But that national security threat can become a trigger just to repress any group, and then to do it preemptively, saying, well, you Jehovah Witnesses, I see that sparkle in your eye, you're going to overthrow us, you're a national security threat, thou shalt ban you, right?
Exactly. And what national security is very vaguely defined.
Yeah. Right?
So it's often non-traditional groups that are targeted, so groups like the Jehovah's Witnesses or the Church of Scientology. I actually have some examples from some of the fieldwork that I did in the ways that these groups are talked about is in very negative terms. So, for example, in Armenia, groups like the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Mormons and the Seventh-day Adventists are called soul hunters.
Ooh.
And
that could be a movie, soul hunters.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds really scary, right? But they're perceived as kind of threatening the soul of the Armenian nation, right? Because the Armenian nation is so closely identified with the Armenian Apostolic Church.
Yeah.
The Orthodox Church. And in Georgia, which is another country that I've done field work in around the early 2000s, there were mobs of Orthodox followers of a defrocked extremist Orthodox priest that actually violently attacked groups like the Jehovah's Witnesses and Baptists. You know, they attacked them with clubs and wooden crosses. They burned their literature, and they tried to scare them out of the country. And in a lot of cases, it was reported that the police just stood by and let this happen. And it took quite a bit of time for the government to prosecute the group, even though they eventually did, and they eventually imprisoned the priest that was leading these attacks. But it suggests that there's, you know, the state doesn't always have to engage in active repression, right, to target groups. It can also kind of stand back and let local authorities, local police, even just citizens instigate this repression. And by failing to protect the religious freedom that's enshrined in the Constitution or wherever, it's actually engaging in a form of passive repression.
Yeah, the old wink, wink. Yeah, this is a threat to the national soul, and, you know, obviously defined by one specific denomination, the Apostolic Church or the Orthodox Church or whatever it might be. And, you know, it's a national security threat if you take people away from that national soul. Let's move to the third category. And this, for me, is one of the more interesting ones. And this is countries that repress some religions. And what's interesting there for me is, well, you know, which religions get repressed, which ones don't? What is the general logic here?
So this is actually probably the most difficult category to explain.
Yeah.
Because the logic often hinges on specific circumstances within each country. But in general, we're finding, or what I find, is that states in this category are focusing on repressing the groups that are most threatening, not because of their size, but due to the nature of their threat to the legitimacy of the state. And we're also often finding overlaps between ethnicity and religion in these countries. So a lot of times the groups that are being targeted are those that are associated with a different ethnic group than those than that of the leaders of the state. So maybe I'll talk about Kyrgyzstan here to illustrate, because this is it's interesting that it's the one Central Asian country that is not in that first category.
It's also the one Central Asian state that I've actually had some contact with, and this is, I don't know if I have any impact on their religious policy. This might be a variable to add to your thing, but back in, I think it was 2005, there was a group of Kyrgyzstan political officials who were tasked with the job of trying to define religious liberty in their society. And they made a stop in Seattle and they wanted to talk to, you know, anybody who knew anything about religious liberty. I remember meeting in a coffee shop with them, and I roll up in my cowboy vest and cowboy hat. And okay, they thought it was great because they, John Wayne got to come and advise them on policy here. And I think my statement was, hey, you just got to lay off on everybody. Religious liberty writ large is really good. So don't worry about it. There were stares. I mean, we had a translator there, so I couldn't exactly know what they were saying or the inflections of their voice, what it might have meant in that. But you know, they kind of looked at me saying, all religious freedom for all? You crazy Westerner. You are really odd. The one thing I did get out of it, though, was I got this really cool hat. That's a traditional Kyrgyzstan hat that they gave me, and maybe I'll post that up on our Facebook page for people to look at. So you go visit us at the our Facebook link to see me in the Kyrgyzstan hat. So I'm hoping I had some influence on that. But what's going on in Kyrgyzstan? Who gets repressed? Who doesn't? And why?
Well, I'd love to see the picture of you in the hat, first of all. But,
okay.
I also wish that they had listened to you a little bit more. But in Kyrgyzstan, what we find, kind of contrary to what we would expect, is that the repression is mostly focused on Muslims, not non-Muslim minorities.
Mm.
And, you know, for the most part, non-Muslim minorities have been allowed to operate in the country as long as they register with the state, and those registration requirements were not very cumbersome. This has changed a little bit recently. So in 2009, there was a law that was passed that raised the number of individuals that were needed to register a religion and instituted other repressive policies. And ironically, this was instituted by the guy who took over after the 2005 Tulip Revolution, who ended up being more authoritarian than his predecessor. But, you know, this has meant that non-Muslim groups are, you know, in recent years being targeted a little bit more, but actually, this law has been used to target minority Muslim groups as well, such as the Ahmadis. But back to the repression of all Muslims. Like Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan has a muftiate, right, that's in charge of all Islamic institutions. And like the other Central Asian states, Kyrgyzstan is using the institution to eliminate independent Islamic groups, which they're doing by labeling them as extremists, like the other ones. And again, exaggerating this threat. But why they consider these groups threatening is in the one case because of the nature of some of the things that these groups believe in. For instance, Hizb ut-Tahrir is a group that's active in Kyrgyzstan, and they call for the replacement of the current system with an Islamic one. So they're kind of threatening to the legitimacy of the regime, even though they're not generally recognized as a particularly violent group. But there's also an ethnic component here, which we discover when we look more closely at the identity of the groups that are targeted with repression. So a lot of these groups that are being targeted are associated with the Uzbeks who live in the southern part of the country. There's a region in southern Kyrgyzstan which is quite ethnically diverse. And so ethnic Uzbeks, even though they've been traditionally underrepresented in Kyrgyz politics, have been quite prominent in the private sector as small businessmen. So we might actually be seeing economic motivations for targeting these groups, using religious extremism as an excuse.
Uh-huh. Very interesting. And what about some of the other countries? You mentioned Kyrgyzstan in there. Do you see these other ethnic tensions in some of the other countries that fall into this category? I think isn't Armenia in that category as well?
So the other countries in this category are Bosnia and Ukraine.
Oh, that's right, Bosnia.
And so, for instance, in Bosnia, we'll see repression really depending on the region. So if it's a Muslim region, you'll see the Catholic Croats being targeted, whereas if it's a region that's got more Catholics in it, there'll be Muslims targeted.
Right.
So There is, again, an ethnic component there as well, depending on kind of which region of the country you're looking at. Bosnia is a little bit of a difficult case because it's not a particularly kind of stable state at this point. But Ukraine has similar issues, right, where there are regional concentrations of religious groups that are kind of a minority in the region being targeted in some regions, but then not in others.
Okay, well, with the time we have remaining here, let's go to that last category. We're down by Bosnia right now, and so it's just a stone's throw away from Albania. And that is the country that falls into your fourth category, which is no religions are repressed. It's actually a pretty good scene. So what is it about Albania?
So this is, Albania's a really interesting country, and I'm learning lots about it and still have more to learn. But what we find in Albania is that, you know, it does regulate religion, right? So, for instance, groups have to register to have official status, juridical status, right, to buy property and things like that. But it doesn't restrict religion. It doesn't repress religion. Albania traditionally, just to give a little bit of background, traditionally it's been considered a Muslim-majority country, but there are scholars who question that status today in terms of who's practicing religion in the country. And we don't have current statistics on religious affiliation in the country, but it's believed generally that it is about 62% Muslim, about 32% Christian, and then the rest is either other religions or no religions. But the character of Islam that's been practiced in Albania is associated with a kind of Sufism that's known to be quite tolerant of other religions. And historically, there hasn't been a lot of conflict between Muslims and Christians in the country, with groups even intermarrying, right? So somewhat similar to what you heard, you know, about the Balkans before the violence broke out. But what's interesting about Albania and that makes it different is its history with communism is a bit different than the other post-communist states. It was the only country to completely ban religion. In 1967, it banned religion. It was the only completely atheistic state. So even though religion was repressed quite a bit in the rest of the Soviet Union and the communist bloc, it was even more extreme in Albania. And so it means that today the population is quite secular, but there are still some who are still religious. So a survey from the World Value Survey from 2002 says that about 24% of respondents attend services once a week or more often. So there is about a quarter of the country that's religious. But Albania is also unique in that there doesn't seem to be a lot of competition or hostility between religious groups. And part of it has to do with the nature of the type of Islam that is practiced there, as I just mentioned. But others have hypothesized that because religion was so harshly repressed under communist rule, and religious groups were equally repressed, so there was no kind of favoring of some groups or allowing some groups to still practice. These groups all developed this kind of camaraderie that persists to this day. So they're not competing with each other for adherence because they're either Muslims or Christians and they don't really proselytize to each other.
Yeah, it's a big jump across those two faiths. They don't usually see many conversions across that, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they don't, so they're not lobbying the state for repressive restrictions against other groups, right? Because they don't see each other as competitors. And politicians don't see religious divisions as something that they can exploit to win elections and maintain power. So they just kind of choose to ignore religion as something they can manipulate to their benefit.
A live and let live attitude in that respect. Let me finish off, because we are here at closing time, to talk about some of your reflections in doing this. And you're writing a book manuscript on this, and we'll make sure that we visit with you once again once it's published and find out about other places of the world. But your reflections here in the post-Soviet world are very interesting, especially in light of what we talked about earlier on in the podcast about you know, how there was great hope that we were seeing a new democratic era emerge here. And so you've had the opportunity to investigate a number of these countries, do field work in places like, as you mentioned, Russia and other places. What's your general sense of where the region is going? Is there some optimism to be had, or is it, boy, this creeping authoritarianism is just going to be what we're going to have to live with for the next several decades, and, you know, you churches are repressed, well, you know, too bad, and that's how it is. So just your general feel of what's happening here.
I wish I could be more optimistic. I think that, you know, the in terms of kind of religious liberty, I'm not super optimistic, partly because the groups and the people who are pushing for greater attention to human rights, including religious freedom, are groups like the United Nations or non-governmental organizations like Human Rights Watch that are great, but they don't have very much enforcement power. You know, on the other hand, while we have seen some improvements in religious freedom come from this kind of EU accession process, you know, perhaps if we have things like the EU enlarge to incorporate more states, we might see some improvement in religious freedom. But I don't really see there being much incentive for a place like Uzbekistan to institute greater religious freedom at this point. You know, I don't really, in terms of creeping authoritarianism, I'm not highly optimistic in terms of where these countries are going. So, for instance, Armenia just had an election last week, and the incumbent won, not surprisingly. And so, you know, even though there were opposition movements, right, it's a competitive authoritarian country, and there were groups that were able to compete, they, you know, there was enough corruption, there was enough, you know, fiddling with political processes and enough repression of kind of pluralism in these countries to not make, you know, real competition be, you know, an option in those countries. So I wish I could be more optimistic. At this point, I'm not. But, you know, maybe that's just a function of my nature.
Yeah, it could. But then again, there's always a chance that we can be surprised, just as we mentioned in the earlier podcast, that the fall of the Berlin Wall caught us both off guard, and, you know, no social scientist really anticipated or expected that. So even though it looks pretty pessimistic, there might be some hope for the future, and we can always do that.
Right, and, you know, the Arab Spring protests are another example of there being things that take us by surprise. So
we will watch out for surprises on the horizon, and we'll check back with you when you publish your book. And I just want to say, Ani, thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.